This hour of the show, Alfred Hitchcock. You may be aware that very shortly before his 112th birthday, footage from a lost silent movie featuring work by Alfred Hitchcock was discovered in New Zealand. It was from 1923, a melodrama starring U.S. actor Betty Compson as twin sisters. One sister was good, one sister was evil, and Clive Brook. And this was the first film that the 24-year-old Hitchcock worked on. He was writer, assistant director, editor, and production designer on the project. We thought it was a perfect chance for us to talk about Alfred Hitchcock. I can't believe how many films this guy put together. It is just phenomenal. Had a chance over the last few days to watch. I must tell you that I have a hard time with horror films, so that I have to watch part of them in the kitchen and part of them where the movie is actually on in the living room, because I get just so nervous about the whole thing. So I watched Vertigo and also Notorious over the past couple days. Bill Crone is our guest, and he's seen all of them. He is a Hollywood correspondent for the movie magazine Cahiers du Cinéma, and he is author of Hitchcock at Work, which is a huge book filled with wonderful photographs of all of the films, and Masters of Cinema, Alfred Hitchcock. We'll be welcoming phone calls from you during the course of this hour. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Bill, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
How do you do?
Hi. This was quite a find, wasn't it, to find these three reels?
Yes, I think it's really exciting. I think I can't wait to see them. They're being screened at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences on the 22nd of September.
And how were they discovered?
They were in cans labeled Twin Sisters. And that's the way discoveries are made. When a friend of mine found Orson Welles' lost footage for It's All True, which I worked on putting together and putting out in 1994. It was in cans labeled Benito. All is true. So that's just the way, that's how we keep getting surprised.
And would you be able, I know you haven't seen it yet, but in that very first work of his, is there some kind of Hitchcock signature that you can always tell it's his work?
No, but there are a lot of things about the White Shadow that are going to be, I think, very revealing about Hitchcock. Certainly the idea of having twin sisters, one good and one evil, it sounds like a Hitchcock film. That's part of the fun of this one. Let me correct something that you said, though, okay?
Sure.
This isn't the first one. This is the second one. The first one is still missing. It's called Woman to Woman, and it's on the BFI's list of 75 most wanted films right now, most wanted English films. The other thing is that it isn't, and you've been careful about to say it, it isn't really a film that was directed by Hitchcock. It was directed by a man named Graham Cutts, with Hitchcock working on the production design, the script, and the editing. The first film that he did with Cutts was called Woman to Woman. I was just watching the remake of Woman to Woman, since it's not available for viewing, the Hitchcock Cutts version, but the version that was done a couple of years later in the sound period, and it's an incredible melodrama where a woman ends up, she's a girl who has gotten pregnant during World War One. The soldier goes off, vanishes. She thinks he's dead. She raises the child. He gets, he has amnesia. He marries a wealthy woman who refuses to give him children, and they end up taking the child for its own sake while Betty Compson performs for one last time as a cabaret dancer and dies on camera.
Oh,
it's an amazing, while the boy is saying, "Where's my mommy? Where's my mommy?" upstairs. It's the kind of film that Hitchcock started off making himself. It's a pure melodrama, and one of the things that I learned when I was going back and looking at the Hitchcock English films is that was really what he set out to do was these. They weren't horror films. He discovered something. He discovered that way much later because it was commercial and because it suited him. But when he started off, he wanted to be Cecil B. DeMille.
I watched a couple of Hitchcock films over the weekend, Vertigo and Notorious.
Notorious, yeah.
Then I read what you said about Vertigo. Was it unusual for Hitchcock? I didn't know that he had different endings to the film that were written in, and also that it was a very elaborate process of writing these films, right? With different writers sometimes, mm-hmm. different people would take over. Was it usual to have more than one ending, and then he would pick the one he wanted?
Yes. It's been known to happen to Hitchcock. He made a film called Suspicion that had where he shot approximately four endings, I think.
Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm. But that was... that was because the studio didn't want his ending, he sort of, I think, shot it, put it away, and then tried all these others. They did test screenings with it and so on. But the ending he would have liked would have made Cary Grant a murderer, and it's probably somewhere in the RKO archives, that ending of Suspicion, but he was willing to play the game, and he kept trying to come up with other ways out.
So he didn't have big arguments with the studio, listen, it's my ending or no ending?
No, he was not a my way or the highway kind of guy, although he certainly got his way most of the time. He didn't do it that way.
Mm-hmm. The other thing about all of the films is that not only are they pretty thrilling and suspenseful, but you're involved in a life of the mind when you're watching them, aren't you?
Yes, that's a good way to put it. You're really experiencing... actually, I'd like to ask you, what do you mean when you say you're involved in the life of the mind?
You're involved in the minds of the characters that you're mm-hmm. seeing, and also you're trying to... Well, you're also trying to figure out, it's like this elaborate puzzle, what exactly is going on here.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the case of Vertigo, and you were watching Notorious, you said, certainly you're trying to figure out what is going on in Cary Grant's mind
mm-hmm.
in that one, because
right.
he is being so mean to Ingrid Bergman, and at the same time he loves her, he doesn't show his feelings, there's that scene that I like that Hitchcock pointed out to François Truffaut when he was doing their famous interview book, where you're watching in the FBI headquarters, you're watching Ingrid Bergman give an important piece of news, and you're watching the people in the office react to it, and you're watching Cary Grant react to it, but the only close-ups are of her and Cary Grant, so that what everyone thinks is going on is not what's really going on.
Right.
It's really what's
right.
going on inside those two people.
Right. Are there a couple of his films that you, I know you find all of them absorbing, but you could watch endlessly and still not see everything that is to be seen in the film? They are endlessly fascinating?
I believe that that's true of all of his work.
Really?
Yeah, I think that's what's fascinating and kind of a puzzle, because certainly there are many directors whose work I could watch over and over and discover new things. You know, John Ford, whom Hitchcock admired, would be one example. But the thing about Hitchcock is that he's just inexhaustible.
Mm-hmm.
And he's inexhaustible in all sorts of ways. You could say intellectually, maybe, because you know it is a kind of cerebral art as well as visceral. But when you go back and back and back, as I have been doing, you keep finding new things. There's no bottom, and that has always suggested to me that Mr. Hitchcock had a brain kind of like one of those supercomputers that they used to do special effects now. You know, they had to wait until computers were created for the army with a huge base to be able to create the kind of wonderful special effects we have today. I think Hitchcock had one of those minds.
Yes, oh, no doubt about that. How many films did he do, Bill? It's just film after film after film.
Well, it's hard to count them if you, you know, unless you just restrict it to features. But I think features he did 54.
Goodness, isn't that a body of work?
Yeah, it's impressive because it was, you know, it's not easy. When I said that he didn't say my way or the highway, he always got his way. And he worked with a great deal of freedom, and he managed to constantly keep doing new things. And those are not easy things to pull off in an industry that is devoted to entertainment and making money. The achievement of those films is that they are all or almost all good, and the fact that he made them pretty much the way he wanted to. Starting, let's say, in even from the beginning, when the period that we're talking about, where that film White Shadow was made, where he was working in the shadows of this man Graham Cutts, he was still getting away with an enormous amount because Graham Cutts wasn't probably much of a director. And he was whispering suggestions in his ear all the way through the making of five films. So he was very good at playing apparently the game of the studios and really being on his own game the whole time.
Hmm. Let's talk about a couple of the famous films that have stayed with some people for their whole lives. And the one I'm going to mention, of course, is Psycho. He said about Psycho, "I once made a movie rather..." And tell me what you think he meant by this. Tongue-in-cheek, mm-hmm. called Psycho. This film had a horrible scene in the beginning of a girl being murdered in the shower. But as the film developed, I put less and less physical horror into it because I was leaving that in the mind of the audience. Toward the end, I had no violence at all. But the audience by this time was screaming in agony. Thank goodness.
I'm working on Psycho right now.
Are you?
Oh yes, and keep finding new things in it. And I interviewed Wes Craven, the man who made the Scream films, recently for the Cahiers, and when Scream 4 was coming out, and just about his whole career. And I'm sure he was thinking of the shower sequence when he said this, that when he teaches film, he tells his students, the person you have to make the audience afraid of is you.
Mm.
In other words, once that has happened in Psycho, once the person you've been following in Janet Leigh and you've been identifying with and so on is murdered in that ghastly fashion, 30 minutes into the film, anything can happen. Or as John Landis, another filmmaker, put it, you are no longer in the hands of a master, you're in the hands of a maniac.
Hmm.
And that's what's really frightening. Once you've gotten your bluff in on the audience that way, you really don't have to do a lot of gore.
Mm-hmm. And where did he get that fascination with that? It's sort of an unusual way to spend your life when you think about it. Where did it come from?
He was afraid of everything.
Was he really?
He had an anxiety complex, I think we would probably say today. And I would guess that he kept it under control through equal doses of, brandy and art and courage. Because if, as Robert Boyle, a production designer who died recently, who worked on The Birds, when I asked him if Hitchcock was scared of birds, Boyle said he was scared of everything. He would look out, if he looked out a second story window, his hands would start to sweat. And I think that courage is probably the main ingredient in those three parts that I just said, because he kept on taking on bigger and bigger challenges, such as making a movie about birds,
mm-hmm.
which are totally uncontrollable, actors, and spending a lot of money on it and going right up to the end with experiment and innovation on the soundtrack and so on, while the studio was worrying about its investment, and he didn't blink. He somehow had it in him to overcome his own fears, and one of the ways that he obviously did that was by putting him on screen.
We're talking about Alfred Hitchcock this hour of the program, and our guest is Bill Crone, Hollywood correspondent for the movie magazine Cahiers Cinéma, author of Hitchcock at Work and Masters of Cinema, Alfred Hitchcock. We're talking about the early film, which was found in New Zealand to celebrate his 112th birthday, just happened to coincide with his birthday, and we're looking at his life and work this hour of the program. Our phone number, feel free to join the conversation. There are, I'm sure, certain Hitchcock films that you remember quite vividly, and we're looking at... I didn't know he was afraid of everything. I met him once at WGN where I worked years ago, and I sure was afraid of him. Maybe he put together this persona that made you afraid to talk to him. I can remember meeting him vividly as I think about it right now. We have the man who knows everything about all the Hitchcock films and Hitchcock himself. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I think my mother scared me when I was 3 months old.
You
see, that? She said, boo. It gave me the hiccups.
Yes.
And she apparently was very satisfied. All mothers do it, you know. That's how fear starts in everyone.
Alfred Hitchcock on the Dick Cavett Show. His mother scared him. That explains the whole thing, right, Bill?
Well, the story that he always told was the one about his father having him put in jail when he was, I think, 5 years old. The village constable was a friend of William Hitchcock, and he had his friend the constable arrest Hitchcock, book him, put him in jail. and afterwards explained that, you know, without telling him that what was up, and afterwards said, this is what happens to bad little boys. He had done it to teach him a lesson, and of course it was a lesson that stayed with him the rest of his life. It's said that he had on his tombstone, this is what we do to bad little boys.
Oh, my. Let's go to some phone calls. We start with Bill in Milwaukee. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, everybody. What an interesting show. As I was growing up with Hitchcock, especially when I was in college, I heard a lot of legends about Hitchcock's really twisted sense of humor. I heard that he sent Melanie Griffith a doll of Tippi Hedren dressed with the birds and a coffin. I heard that he ran ice water through the spigot in the shower in the beginning of the shower scene to get a genuine scream out of Janet Leigh, and she was furious. I heard a lot about really peculiar sense of humor from Hitchcock. Was this true?
He was a practical joker, but the two stories that you just repeated aren't true. He didn't do that to Janet Leigh in the shower sequence, and they used warm water the whole time. And the present that he gave Tippi Hedren's daughter, Melanie Griffith, when she was a little girl, was a picture of her mother. It was a doll of her mother in a box. But it wasn't a coffin. He just had a doll made looking like Tippi to give the little girl for her birthday, and it frightened her for some reason. So Hitchcock's second biographer, Donald Spoto, made a big deal out of that. But Camille Paglia interviewed Tippi Hedren for a little book on the birds that she did for the British Film Institute. And Hedren said that was nonsense. It was a nice present.
Hmm. And what about Janet Leigh? Is it true she never took a shower again?
I think she has said that, yeah.
I thought I had. That is true then. Oh, you know, he took these people who you think of. I mean, Jimmy Stewart's in quite a few of his films, and it's Jimmy Stewart of It's a Wonderful Life, and here he is in a totally, totally different role. Tell me how he, was it his power as a filmmaker that got people like Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart, Kim Novak, to be Ingrid Bergman to be in his films?
Well, he used to always say that he would just as soon cast every lead with Cary Grant. He just they really were made for each other. But the star thing was, it's the way he had learned to make movies from his first boss, his first American boss, David O. Selznick, who did these big star vehicles. The very first film he did for Selznick, Rebecca, actually made Joan Fontana a star. But he knew that you had to do that to get people into the theater. He knew you had to supply all sorts of reasons to use your eyes and your spirit and your heart to understand this great art form he was helping to create. As I said, he was very happy to play the game if it didn't get in the way of the work.
And why were he and Cary Grant made for each other?
Because Cary Grant was such a brilliant actor, and, of course, they were both British. But because Cary Grant was very ambivalent when he played for Hitchcock, he, as you saw in Notorious, he had this dark side, and you have that shot in Notorious where in Suspicion, I should say, which was the first film he did with Grant, where you don't know if he's a wife murderer or not. And he kisses Joan Fontaine the first time the camera goes around them. And on one side of the shot, Cary Grant's face is in light. On the other side, it's in darkness. And that's the way he saw Grant. And he was able to get that out of Grant in a way that nobody else ever did.
Let's go to Marty in Sister Bay next. Hi, Marty.
Hi. Correct me if I'm wrong. I know that his male actors came back and wanted to perform in his film several times, but I believe that the women actors generally didn't come back, and I thought I understand that he didn't treat them the same. The women actors didn't like how he treated them. Is that correct?
No. Again, that's the biography, The Dark Side of Genius by Donald Spoto, and you know, it's a valuable book in that he was the first person to actually go out and do research. John Russell Taylor had done an authorized biography. The problem with Spoto's book is that you don't know what's true in it and what isn't. He has a very slanted view of Hitchcock, which maybe comes from the fact that he himself was a former Benedictine monk who had failed in his vows and then decided to do celebrity biographies. But he tended to be looking for these things, and he tended to find them. The story about the supposed doll in the coffin is a pretty good example. Tiffy Hedren, I think, had a bad experience with Hitchcock, but Ingrid Bergman certainly didn't, and she worked with him on a number of films. And generally, actresses and actors loved him. He had that famous line about actors are cattle, but it was a line he once used to shock an actor who wasn't trying hard enough. As far as doing things to the actresses, no. They were, they loved Hitchcock as a rule. And another shining example would be Grace Kelly.
And why did they love him?
He was sweet. He was funny. He was very chivalrous. He was... He knew how to make them look great. He knew how to find all these depths in performance. There's a story that Peter Ustinov told about a Lifeboat. The beautiful actress who's playing the nurse on the Lifeboat needed to cry, and he said, hold your breath, count to da-da-da, and then start speaking, and you'll sound right. You know, he was really good with actors.
Hmm.
And he, of course, went out of his way to endear himself to all of them. You don't really make it at the level that he did in Hollywood by being horrible to your to your main ingredient.
Right. Let's talk about North by Northwest. A lot of people have seen that film. One review I was reading said that it is perhaps Hitchcock's most fully realized film.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not exactly sure what that means, but would you agree with whatever you think that means?
Whatever I think it
yeah.
means, I think it's true. He brought to perfection a certain kind of spy thriller that he had invented,
mm-hmm.
really, in England. And I don't think he could have he could have improved on it. That's why it was kind of unfortunate that Universal, when he became a stockholder in that studio and a resident of that studio, kept giving him spy thrillers to make, because he had invented this genre. He had carried it to the absolute heights with North by Northwest, and everybody was doing imitations. You know, that's where the James Bond films come from. So naturally, Universal looked at him and said, why don't you do Torn Curtain? Why don't you do Topaz? And in a sense, he was like the magic frog in the cartoon. He'd been there, done that. He wanted to do, Psycho. He wanted to do the Birds. Actually, Psycho is the film he did right after North by Northwest, and one couldn't imagine a more different film. He didn't want to keep doing the same thing.
I like those spy thrillers. I just like spy thrillers.
Yeah, it's a fun genre, and it's one of the genres that kind of kept Hollywood going in the 60s, Spy spoofs and things
right.
like that, charade. That when they couldn't get Hitchcock to do it, they would get Cary Grant.
Hmm.
and Audrey Hepburn and do a Hitchcock pastiche like charade. It's a lot of fun.
I don't know what your first Hitchcock film was, but I'll ask you that in conjunction with this Facebook comment from Chris, whose son is 15 and is going to be a sophomore in high school. She thinks he's old enough for his first Hitchcock film and asks you, what should the first one be? She's toying with the birds, but doesn't know if she wants to totally freak him out. What would you recommend?
Sure, the birds is great. I think that the one we've been talking about would probably be the best thing for a kid. North by Northwest. It's just it's a dazzling filmmaking. If that doesn't get him hooked, nothing will. But he will continue to take showers and unlike my sister Carolyn, who's listening to this, will not be terrified of birds for the rest of his life. She was born that way, but she couldn't go see the birds.
She couldn't see it. I have problems with that film as well.
Well, problems of what sort?
With, you know, the birds. I think I saw that years ago, and I've forever looked at birds differently. And they're going to run into my head. They're omnipresent. They are a little creepy to me. And that's terrible to say because I know a lot of people love birds in our audience. But it was because of that film it changed my perception of birds.
Well, and did you see the hilarious slow-burning trailer that he did where he's the star?
Yes, yes.
And he explains that... And he proceeds to demonstrate all the reasons why birds might attack, offering a roast bird dinner up and so on, and then they're outside and they're coming for him. But, of course, we do treat birds abominably, you know, the idea that a whole species like that might turn on us, it was a very... again, it became a genre, you know, frogs and bees and so on. They threw everything at the audience they could after that because he had invented another genre, you know. But to make the ordinary household or the ordinary everyday creature, the bird, into a symbol of terror was a very good example of what he did.
Mm-hmm. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we go to Emily next in Milwaukee. Hi, Emily.
Hi. I am a film student, or an incoming film student, and last year, my first real experience with Hitchcock was in a film class that I had to take where we sort of focused on him as a director. And one of the films we saw, which I think is my favorite now, was called Rope. And it's about these two guys that kill someone. The film actually just, like, opens up on them. Already have committed the murder of a guy they know. And they dump his body in this chest. And they invite his family and their friends of the guy they killed all to a dinner where they serve... dinner on the chest where they've just, like, essentially buried him. And what I found so amazing about the film was, like, it's all, like, essentially, like, in three shots, I think, where it's just continuously, the camera never stops moving, and not a single person in my class was, like, not on the edge of their seat. And, you know, coming from a generation, all of us film, like, students in that class, where films were sort of, as horror films, were sort of defined by, you know, Saw and Hostel, you know, Final Destination, which came out, which are movies, like, essentially just about the gore and the kill. It's really refreshing, I think. Hitchcock as a director, what he does for me is he shows that horror isn't really about the kill. It's more about the tension and the atmosphere you create. Like, it's really, like, where horror isn't really supposed to be just a gory thing, like...
Well,
it's really just,
you know, he's
the feeling you get. Like, you don't see any gore in that movie. It's all about, you know, the possibility of what could happen.
What could happen? Let's get a response, Bill.
I'm sorry, I jumped in there.
No, it's all right.
First of all, he is to blame for the gore cycle that came after 1960 in Psycho. I think that the lesson of Rope is, again, how very ordinary things can become scary or suspenseful when you know something that the characters don't, which is in that case that there's a dead body in that box that they're eating dinner off of, and all you have to do is establish one little thing like that, and then suddenly everything that the people in the film say, everything they do, everything that they think becomes heightened to you, that's the technique that enables him to do what you're calling suggestion, or the life of the mind, or whatever. He puts you inside the characters because you're observing them, and because you're in an odd way made to care about them. Because who are you afraid for in Rope? Those two guys that murdered a perfectly innocent schoolmate and stuck him in a box and are doing this horrible thing. But every time somebody's about to open the box, you're scared.
Right. Right. He's a master at that. Was he, when you said earlier that he was a guy who had anxiety complexes, was he able to work through some of those? And do people who also share anxiety complexes, can you work through that as you watch these films?
If you're a genius on the level of Leonardo da Vinci, you can work through it by making them. Otherwise, you pay your ticket and you buy your ticket I think that scary movies do a lot to help people deal with their own anxieties. I don't think people would line up to have Hitchcock go boo if they weren't getting something deep out of it. Maybe that's as good an example. That's as good a theory as I have been able to propose. He kept them coming back.
Sure did. Bill Krohn, our guest this hour, Hollywood correspondent for the movie magazine Kaya Cinema, author of Hitchcock at Work and Masters of Cinema, Alfred Hitchcock. We're talking about Hitchcock because one of his earliest works was discovered, silent film in New Zealand, and also because it would have been his 112th birthday last week. And because it's fun to talk about Alfred Hitchcock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, what am I going to talk about? Lectures usually give them travel or current events, don't they?
Oh, Charles, not current events. We get current events.
What sort of an audience would it be?
Oh, women like myself, busy with our homes, most of us.
Women keep busy in towns like this. The cities, it's different. The cities are full of women, middle-aged widows, husbands dead. Husbands who've spent their lives making fortunes, working and working. Then they die and leave their money to their wives, their silly wives. And what do the wives do, these useless women? You see them in the hotels, the best hotels, every day by the thousands. Drinking the money, eating the money, losing the money at bridge, playing all day and all night, smelling of money. Proud of their jewelry, but of nothing else. Horrible. Faded, fat, greedy women.
They're alive. They're human beings.
Are they?
Oh, my goodness. You don't even have to see it to get involved in the dialogue in that.
That's Joseph Cotten in Shadow of a Doubt.
1943.
Right. And the dialogue that you, the wonderful dialogue that we just heard was by Thornton Wilder. Of all people, he and Hitchcock wrote the script on a train, and then Hitchcock had other people getting involved. But I'm pretty sure that famous speech was by Thornton Wilder. He liked to work with He said there were two kinds of writers. There were people that could adapt something that already existed into, a screenplay. And there were people who could make up characters and stories out of their heads. And he preferred the latter. He liked working with novelists and playwrights. And in the case of Shadow of a Doubt, it was made up completely out of whole cloth. There was no story. There was some kind of a case of a serial killer being caught in his hometown in California that triggered the idea. But apart from that, they were making it up. He had great respect for writers who had that that gift of imagination.
And he worked with some great ones, didn't he?
John Steinbeck on Lifeboat, although Steinbeck later, actually the people who tended to knock him afterwards tended to be writers because they didn't like to be rewritten. Steinbeck was one of those.
Hmm. Let's go to Wanda in Middleton next. Hi, Wanda.
Oh, what a breathtaking show. I appreciate the guest. I don't think he's going deep enough because I don't think you have to make a distinction the important issues of life, life and death, love and hate, fear and a sense of safety or comfort and love. Surely that had gone on in Hitchcock's early life. There's a little child in all of us. He never got over this fear, you said, and that was such great insight on your part or whoever you read or however that idea came to you. It was great insight. But I don't think you address the fact that Hitchcock didn't really love his audience. Why is this wonderful hostess afraid of birds?
You mean the hostess?
I think she means me. Why am I afraid of birds?
Oh, why are you afraid of birds? Wait, right. In other words, was he being sadistic with the audience? Sure. I think it would be. It's actually an interesting point, and I think it would be worth following up about Hitchcock. The same thing that made him play practical jokes, and even though he didn't play the two we were cited, he did in fact play some pretty big ones. Practical jokers have a sadistic streak in them. There's no question, and I don't want to whitewash that out of Hitchcock. I think it actually is one of the interesting things. Why did he? What was his attitude toward the audience? He once referred to them in talking to one of his writers. I don't think it was Thornton Wilde. It was somebody who would tell tales afterwards. He referred to them as the moron millions.
Oh, my.
Yeah, no, I'm trying not to whitewash him
right here.
But I can promise you that people in this business, in the film business, have a very peculiar audience, a very peculiar attitude towards audiences, and your wonderful listener has put her finger right on it. What is the what is it that drives people to make these big spectacles that move and frighten and entertain in all sorts of ways, billions of people. Hitchcock was not satisfied with a local audience in England or an English language audience. He said, we make films, and he meant we, Hollywood directors, for people in Japan. They have to be able to react to him the same way they do everywhere else. He made films that were shown all over the world. So at the same time, he wanted a very big audience, and at the same time, his attitudes toward them were complex. I think that could be the subject for a book.
Right. Well, and I'm reminded of this. This is about the relationship with his audience. A lot of people were just unnerved by the shower scene in Psycho, and he evidently, to a woman who complained, this scene was had so frightened her daughter that the girl would no longer shower, his answer was, "Then, madam, I suggest you have her dry cleaned."
Yes.
Whoa, what's that? Have her dry cleaned, please.
Well, have her dry cleaned is just an example of his wonderful humor. And
exactly.
Practical jokes are also supposed to be funny. And generally the ones he played, while quite amazing, you know, elaborate, were pretty funny when you think about them. Like having a dinner where all the food was blue. Not explaining anything, just serving it up to the guests. He was a joker. He was a bit of a surrealist. He said that his ideal was that you could just plant a wire in the brains of every member of the audience and play them like an organ. The emotions and all of that. And that's essentially what he was doing. These films are certainly, the word manipulation has become, suspect in a way. You'll see it in reviews, oh, this is a manipulative scene, or the director has a very manipulative audience attitude towards the audience. Well, you know, that's the very essence of what Hitchcock is doing.
Let's go to Brian in Superior. Hi, Brian.
Hi.
Hi.
I got a couple of things. One of my favorites of his early films was Young and Innocent, which is like a early version of North by Northwest.
Absolutely, yeah.
The guy wrongfully accused, but my favorite part is that end with that large tracking shot that goes over I don't know how many minutes, showing the whole room and zooming over the wall and coming in and in and in closer and closer. But I won't ruin it for everybody.
Thank you.
And then the other thing is there's a Truffaut book, Francois Truffaut. I don't think you mentioned it, where he interviewed him back in 1962 and they turned it into a book. But I just discovered on the Internet Archive, archive.org, it's like 12 and a half hours of interviews are all there to download and listen to, and he talks about his whole career up to 1962, and it's just fascinating to hear him talk about everything. And it's just, I was going to, after you get done here, I'll probably listen to a little bit of it here while I'm working.
Bill.
Well, the first comment about Young and Innocent, I agree, it's one of my favorite Hitchcock films, and that scene where the camera slowly moves in on a single detail is probably done to perfection in Notorious, where the camera drops down from a height overlooking a big party that's going on all the way to Ingrid Bergman's closed hand, which contains a key.
Yes, oh my.
And that picking out of a single detail, mm-hmm. which is significant to the audience, but to no one around her, and to Ingrid Bergman, but to no one around her, is another great Hitchcock manipulation. It's really good to have those Hitchcock Truffaut interviews available for listening. Let me recommend another resource to people who are interested in Hitchcock. There's a thing on the net now called 1,000 Frames of Hitchcock. If you just Google 1,000 Frames of Hitchcock, you will see 1,000 shots from all the films, each film shot by shot.
Great.
And it's a fascinating way to notice some of the things he was doing. If you look at Vertigo, which is one of the films you looked at this weekend, and you just look at it as a single page, it's got daylight or fully lit scenes at the top and at the bottom, but in the middle there's this great black band of darkness, of night. And you can learn all sorts of things from looking at 1,000 frames of Hitchcock. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, and let me recommend your book, too, because there are descriptions of the frames and wonderful pictures in Bill's book as well. We're plumb out of time, Bill. Thank you so much for being with
us. Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it. It went fast.
It did go fast, didn't it? celebrate Alfred Hitchcock's 112th birthday a little belatedly. Bill's book, and it is, we got it at the library, at work, Hitchcock, Mr. Hitchcock, at work. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And thanks for all of your calls. We're with you again tomorrow at 9.